being orange and green, so now I'm Dean. Thank you. That was a piece, as you see, that Dean arranged for the harp. And he's off biking this morning, so he's asked me to welcome you as Vice President. Our President Bart Crump is also not able to be here today. I'd like to welcome you all to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society and Rosemary Lister's and Michael Chalice.
Okay, I light the chalice for the growing number of young people in the new multi-ethnic, multi-racial movement. They are the young people who refuse to accept the images laid on them by both the all-white or the all-black political factions. And I particularly like this for, and I salute Tiger Woods in this respect, who told millions of people via Oprah Winfrey that he was, quote-unquote, Tablin Asian, that is, Caucasian, Black, Indian, and Asian. And he respected all of his ancestors, regardless of political expediency.
We're now going to sing hymn number 107 in the Prairie Songbook, The Spirit of This Church.
I think you probably all know this song, but I can run through it once. I'll just give you the first chorus so you sort of know what it is. I'll just give you the first couple of bars. Translation begins, it's a couple walking and watching the queen. Each, in the words say, each knew the other's heart was full, but neither gave expression. The whole summer passed, and neither one said, I love you, to the other one.
I don't need to carry on.
And in connection with that, please read slowly the poem that
Barbara gave me to put on the back. It's one of from her treasure house of poetry that she could just rattle off and drop off her needle.
Thank you for doing it. No, I've only heard it in Welsh, and in Welsh it's a real... Other joys and sorrows?
I have a new car. Well, I mean second hand, but
we're
going to improve
it over the
other car.
Oh,
well, that's good.
Oh,
well, you know, Lily is up out in Montana digging up rocks. And yesterday she called her mother because she didn't know what to do because they were climbing this mountain and they met a bear cub.
Oh.
And it was a grizzly bear cub. And they ran all the rest of the way. Her mother doesn't know what to do because the director of the camp only has the kids going in pairs. And if one got hurt and had to go for help, this person would, she said, everywhere else she's gone, they have three people together, not two. And she doesn't know what to do. Should she tell the director? Should she what? She's all worried now because she's not going up that mountain again.
We found something Lily's afraid of. Yeah, I guess this is a sorrow. Most of you know I have a beautiful 10-month-old, now technically a 10-month-old daughter who's out with Tara and Katrina. And I also have two cats. And the sorrow is that the elderly cat seems to be attempting to cohabit in the exact same space as my daughter. And it's leading to a lot of problems. And as much as I love her, I think she needs to go to a new home. So if anyone knows of anyone who would be interested in taking an almost 20-year-old cat with a lot of geriatric problems, she still has some life in her. She's very stubborn. She's very affectionate. But the cohabitation with her and my child is not working out. And so I'm asked to see if anybody here might be interested in those someone else might. So, and this needs to be resolved very soon. So, unfortunately. Any other doors and concerns? Okay, in which case I will turn the program over to the few of you.
We wanted to continue with our program about images, and last week, if you were here, what we talked about is that people make images deliberately. My part, when a person makes a photograph, and notice I say make and not take, this person makes a photograph. They know, if they are a photographer who knows what they're doing, they are saying something specific and they want to try to say that thing to you. And because this is a church of sorts, we wanted to relate imagery to spirituality. And so last week, some of it was a little bit depressing, I think, to people to see images that are used in a not-so-positive way. You can take images and you can use them to try to make people go along with your point of view. And if your point of view happens to be anti-whatever, then you use images in a not-so-positive way. But there are a lot of reasons why people produce images and what images are for. And so what I'm going to focus on and Rosemary's going to focus on is I want to show you how photography for some people is the same thing as religion or prayer. And it's a different use of photography than the idea of using it for a political message. And there are ways that photography is connected quite specifically to spirituality. So... I'm
going
to turn it on.
Oh,
I can always hold the slides. I can hold them, but I don't think everybody can see them. This is called The Illuminated Man. It's by Dwayne Michaels, who does a lot of explorations that have to do specifically with people and God. But Art, poetry, and music, as they are in their ordinary functioning, include mental and visual, not spiritual values. But they can be turned to a higher end, and then, like all things, are capable of linking our consciousness to the divine. They are transmuted and become spiritual and can be admitted as a part of the life of prayer. There was a photographer named Minor White who was the editor of a critical photography magazine called Aperture. Aperture still exists today. And he was very, very much concerned with photography as spiritual expression. He was particularly interested in Zen and other Eastern religions. But he put out an issue of Aperture early on in the 1950s when it was started called Octave of Prayer, in which it was specifically relating photography and spiritual matters. And in this, he says, the theme Octave of Prayer comes from my personal realization that at times photography and prayer overlap. I first noticed this intersecting of the two while I was a mid-century soldier not allowed to photograph during boot camp. I turned my energies to religion. I was surprised and pleased, if not grateful, to find the energies exercised in prayer were the same as I had brought to making photographs. Later, in 1971, Ralph Hattersley published a verification of this when he wrote in Discover Yourself in Photography. A great many people are aware that in some mysterious way, photography is a kind of religion for them. They would not express themselves in such words, of course, nor would they equate photography with, say, Christianity, Buddhism, or Vedanta. Nevertheless, photography has come closer to being a religion than anything else they've ever had. Minor White goes on to say, No one knows how many thousands never really realize the connection between their photography and the qualities of religion, prayer, or some form of the esoteric. Yet they continue to photograph because of these very qualities. Photography allows them a consciousness of things, places, and people, a union with certain visual, auditory, and sensory events in the world. The union growing out of rapport or resonance makes the experience an event for them. Union, of course, is a major attribute of prayer. We do not mean the prayer of petition. We mean the kind of prayer technically called meditation by the saints who have researched the several stages of prayer. By the way, in Octave of Prayer, he literally goes through the different stages of prayer. If you read the book, there are seven stages, I think. The feeling of union, of oneness with the object, which we all have experienced previously at one time or another, is, according to the religious, a gift of grace. This is a photograph which actually is not really taken by a photographer, but it sort of expresses some of the sense of spirituality. This is a photograph by NASA of a particular nebula. Any of you who are astronomers would recognize it. Haridas Shapuri, excuse me if I pronounce it wrong, in the philosophy of meditation said, great artists, poets, painters usually start with a sensory, imaginative meditation. Their concentration on a subject like a flower or a mountain assumes the form of an unbroken flow of sense impressions and images related to their object. But eventually, this flow of perception or imagination may result in a flash of aesthetic insight into the heart of the object. The artist experiences intimate oneness with it. The spirit of the object, as it were, enters his soul and causes creative inspiration. Thus, a person who's a master landscape painter is not a person who paints the landscape, but that the landscape paints itself through that person. Likewise, photographers are not even the most famous ones, but any photographer occasionally experiences these identical sensations. Some force, not of their doing, working through them, works through the camera. And you will find that many photographers will speak this way, that they didn't take the photograph came through them. And the difference between a scientist, philosopher, artist, photographer, and the devout lies not in the profession or the process, but in the object of meditation. When the object of a photograph or other art form is secular, The viewing state might be experienced as meditation. When that object is religious, the viewer might feel that he or she is engaged in prayer. So oftentimes, as Minor Light was pointing out, photographers do actually feel like they are in a state of prayer, but they would not call it that, because we don't call such things in the secular world. We don't admit or call things this. There was a woman named Evelyn Underhill in her book on mysticism who compares the life of prayer to a journey in the fog. As a fog lifts occasionally, some object, a pine tree or star, is seen. Later, this object is described as a landmark on the way, a mystic rose of vision. Well, by the way, and most photographers are doing the same thing, or artists, they are looking for that landmark, they are looking for that vision. And all their life, their photographs are working toward that vision that they're trying to find. With the research of centuries behind us, the way of prayer resembles, intellectually at least, a broad, well-lit street. Nevertheless, that street must still be traveled on hands and knees in a fog. The human psyche is just that strange. Even the apparent lucidity of those who write about prayer is little more than steam coming from a manhole. Now I want to show you just briefly the work of three photographers who in their own way are working toward, who wanted to express spiritual matters. And they're three very different photographers, but this is just to give you an idea of when you look at a photograph, you may see steam coming out of a manhole, but the intent of the photographer, in fact, may have been much different. The first photographer I actually briefly talked about last time, his name is Ralph Eugene Meatyard. And Ralph Eugene Meatyard was a Kentucky optician who was very good friends with the religious philosopher Thomas Merton, and in fact very interested in spiritual matters. He created uncanny pictures which give the feeling of not quite being of this world. Meatyard's portraits were often blurred or mysterious, suggesting that the human figure is composed of and can be depicted as a form of energy that is not entirely separable from the physical environment. His images deal with transition. They may suggest waiting, arrival, and departure rather than a static state. Unfortunately, Meatyard died very young, at age 47, of cancer when he was just really in the height of his photographic career. By the way, this is a person, you don't have to go anywhere. This is a man who lived in Kentucky, never left Kentucky, photographed only around his home, didn't go around the world. He was just a person whose insights and vision and practice of photography took place all in one small contained area with his family and his friends. After his death, a statement from his son about Meatyard's vision and work brought together this man's concern with the literal aspects of vision. He was an optician. He was an optician, and he worked with sight, with realities of vision. And the statement from his son brings together the connection between the literal interest in sight and his interest in the spiritual vision, which is, his son said about his father, "The joy of seeing lies not only in emotions, but in the psychology of using vision and the mystery of how we see." A very different photographer who some of you probably know and have seen his work is Ansel Adams. Ansel Adams' concern to get away from the small interior spiritual vision of a man in Kentucky, Ansel Adams was a person who was very committed and was a part of the Western vision. And as a Westerner myself, by the way, I consider that I'm in the East. Anytime you're in East of the Mississippi River, this is definitely the East. I'm from the real West. I mean, Oregon is as far as you can go. But this is definitely the East. But there is, as you know, in our American psyche, the West. There is a mythology of the West. There is a the West out there. And Ansel, who was from California and was greatly moved by nature and was a part of nature, for him, the West is a magnificent sacred object, a visual metaphor, and a catalyst for reverence, exaltation, and veneration. and all his photography of nature in the West is focused toward this point. He used as his symbols the silhouetted landscape, the dark sky, the dramatic cloud formations. All sense of human scale is lost. The more subdued moments of earth and sky have given way to more spectacular moments, dawn and dusk, sunrise and moonrise, thunderstorm and spotted image. With very few exceptions, the intentions of Adam's major work is mythic. The sense of the presence of the eternal in Adam's photographs is achieved not only by his constant choice of the sublime moment, remember he's choosing exactly what he wants to show you. It's chosen not only by the fact that he chooses a sublime moment or view, but also by his legendary technical brilliance, which transforms an ordinary scene into a luminescent, fully realized, precious object. Thus, a lone tree branch on the shore of Mona Lake could be made to stand out as if a spotlight against the luminescent floating background. And this is what I, from last week, is telling you. He made these photos look this way. If you went to that scene, you would not have seen that. The same with the previous picture. Because he had this in his mind to say, and this is what he wanted to say to you. And Ansel Adams was absolutely a master technician. And when you saw his photographs are exactly what he wants you to see. So you definitely did not see this. He purposely took this photograph so you have the luminescent view of the floating clouds, which is actually a reflection in the lake, and the brilliance of that standing out in front of it. Or the north sky beyond Yosemite's half tone could be rendered in a rich velvet black. And again, he did this. You would not see that if you went to Yosemite. And I can guarantee you, you will not see this. This is Ansel Adams' vision. This is in his mind. This is his feeling of the sacredness and how nature is a sense for him of spirituality. And this is what he wanted to communicate to you. Now, to come back to one other person, Minor White, who's the person who put together the Octave of Prayer, his photographs, again, are different. Whereas Ansel Adams felt strongly about the spiritual power of nature, Minor White was very interested in, as I said, Zen and other Eastern thought. His intention was to discover the main animistic features of the universe and man as they were revealed in simple natural facts and human gestures. White took literally the statement of another photographer who said, "Every object to me is a very alive thing." This basic level of animism and analogy runs all throughout White's work. So in this case, a piece of burnt wood becomes a landscape with a pale moon, for example. All visual form alludes to other cosmic and natural forces and forms. In these photographs, he is able to see not only magnificence, but also sensuousness, darkness, and intimations of estrangement, death, and disaster. His haunting landscapes and cityscapes, if you notice, there's a direct comparison. This is where I'm from, Portland, Oregon. His haunting landscapes and cityscapes, as well as his abstract details, reflect these aspects that he was trying to show. So this is not just a scenic picture. This is not just a picture of a town. He's reflecting the same kind of ideas that are in his head. Unfortunately, those buildings don't exist anymore in Portland. The best of White's photographs give imitations of other realms of consciousness and being. They accomplish this by lyrically organizing the most elemental human and symbolic forms. Forms which in all Western art have related to the occult, sexuality, and the psyche. The circle, the sphere, rings, windows, doors, pools of water, triangular and oval geometric shapes, mouths, eyes. White's primary visual world contains the most primitive natural elements. Light, fog, sea, clouds, mountains, trees, frost, and human gestures. To these visual elements, White frequently added rhetorical phrases, poems, and prayers that narrowed, compounded, contradicted, and expanded the range of interpretation. So he moved beyond his photographs also to add poetry or words that may or may not make it clear, or may make it more complex, or may clarify it for you. And one of those was, "Come to eat of me. Do you expect to escape my hunger? No matter how slow the film, spirit stands still long enough for the photographer it has chosen. All the way to heaven is heaven, for he said, I am the way." I'll give you one last photograph. This is not mine to write, but I thought it was a fitting photograph for the end.
Is there a shadow of a hand on the wall?
No, that's really a hand.
Oh, well, on the wall.
Oh, on the wall, yes. Yes.
How could it be a shadow of a hand?
Yes, right there.
Mysterious.
This is a photograph by Ralph Gibson, who works with dreams. His photographs are always enigmatic because, in particular, he's interested in working in the world of dreams. And these are, by the way, these are not manipulated photographs. He didn't work with manipulated photographs, meaning he didn't do several printings to get this. He photographed.
Under-focus a little bit to make a shot?
He pretended he was doing a film. So that's my part. I have Rosemary here.
If you think you
have.
Thank you.
How many people are there? Do you have some slides? Okay, I'm going to shorten my presentation to the visuals in order to give everybody else a chance to do their thing. And everything that Nikki has said really applies in many ways to the pictures I'm going to show you relatively briefly. In other words, not just crazy theorize. It's quite amazing. I hadn't seen her stuff, and our work and research sort of dovetailed. So this is just a reminder that one of the earliest and most widely prevalent images of spirituality is, of course, church imagery and the image of the Madonna. And this is from the cathedral in Weisach in southwest Germany, a very strict Gothic structure. If you keep in mind that Gothic architecture that exemplifies the striving towards heaven, but amazingly within these very heaven-oriented structures, you find very earthly-looking, worldly-looking persons. In particular,
one moment question.
Yeah.
One of the arms holding the crown appears to be a warrior's arm. The other appears to be a common man or something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the meanings of those hands?
No, I don't. And I think it's possibly an act. I don't know that there is any
similarity.
I really don't think so. But I mean, they look different. But
they're very different. One's a penis.
Where?
The left hand holding the crown.
It's just more elegant fingers.
Versus the right hand, the clumsy, massive hands on the right hand.
But you can see how images can, you know, evoke reactions in people that are quite different. Okay, I want to show you three artists that definitely dealt with spirituality intentionally and with very deep religiosity. This is the general picture of the famous Isenheim altar in Colmar, which is in the French Alsace. And it is considered one of the most magnificent pieces of world art. This altar opens up, and there are many different parts of this, of the Isenheim altar. It was produced in the first third of the 1400s of the 15th century. And, okay, this looks like many altars you've seen, but the painter of this altar, his name is Matthias Grünewald, employed a technique that we would almost call psychedelic. I'll show you in a minute here. This is still fairly, not this, but wait till you see the last pictures. And nobody has been able to track down his technique, his paint technique, and it cannot be, this is not the example of what I'm talking about. This is still the traditional Madonna, the all-encompassing mother image.
But when you see this, this is the most famous part. You see these colors emanating from the Christ figure, very, very unusual for the early 15th century. And the technique I've seen, last summer I've seen the original, and it was mind-boggling. And even modern technology cannot duplicate this use of color. When you look at these iridescent tones, they are very, very unusual for the time. And when you get close, there are some of the close-ups of the suffering Christ, and then he becomes very, very realistic in the pain pictures. And I want to show you what this would be in the bottom of some of the scenes on the triptych of the people suffering from the plague. He does that, but then he goes into totally spiritual imagery in the upper parts of the various parts of the triptych. And here's where I'm saying it's all those psychedelic, this ephemeral, ethereal, a very, very delicate imagery of what he envisions heaven to be and the spirits of heaven, the angels to be. And the last one I'm showing you, very, very floating and total spirit almost. So this is one example of an artist in the early 15th century following his own spirituality. We don't know an awful lot about the man Matthias Grünewald. He remains sort of an enigma, but one of the most talented enigmas in the world of art. Well, this was the 15th century. Now I'm going to take you to the Romantic period in Germany. This is Caspar David Friedrich, a North German, the most important North German Romantic painter in Germany. He lived from 1774 to 1840, so right around the turn. And somebody else painted that off him. But his paintings are mostly focusing on nature and very much God in nature. One could call him a late exponent of pantheism, the movement of people that really started, or one of pantheism's greatest exponents was the German Goethe. And the Romantics, then he went back to that seeing God and the universe in every little sand corn. Those of you who read Lake, you find that Lake uses in his poetry some of this idea. And on top of his spiritual intent, of course, he's one of the greatest landscape painters.
Is that the Matterhorn?
No, that was the Wait. Is it the Matterhorn? No, it's, I forgot the name of it. It's one of the mountain ranges, but not the Matterhorn. He calls this painting The Lonely Tree. And one can assume very much the idea of loneliness, all-encompassing loneliness in people, as exemplified by a tree in nature. So this is his very spiritual and very, in a way, very realistic depiction of nature.
It seems to be a man at the base.
The man isn't important. You see, you'll see in the other pictures, his people usually are with their backs to us and observing, looking into nature. And this becomes very clear here in the harbor of Greifswald, this is on the Baltic Sea, Pomerania. Again, it's a harbor picture, but the people are looking at the harbor, the sunset. You could spend hours thinking about this and thinking about the idea of the harbor, the ships having to do with life, and going off into infinity with the harbor. But he has these multi-layered ideas manifest in his painting that makes them, I think, so fascinating. And the last one I'm showing you of this, again, three people observing the sundown at the Baltic Sea. And you might go to the Baltic Sea, and in this case, unlike your photographers, I spent a lot of time at the ocean side as a child, and I'm sort of an ocean freak. And when the sun goes down, you can see things like this. You can see people silhouetted in dark. But there's more to it than that when Caspar David Friedrich paints that.
And so this is an expression of spirituality. I think that might be close to the Unitarian expression of spirituality, without any configuration of Madonnas or God with a long beard or saints and so forth. And the last one, to me, one of the most significant expressions of spirituality I encountered 2 years ago when I took a group of people to Southwest Germany, and we came to Freiburg. Freiburg in the Black Forest is known not for this church, but for its magnificent Gothic minster or cathedral. On a hill sort of away on the side, there is another church, Church der Stephanskapelle. It looks like this is, it is a later church, later than the Gothic. It's not as ornamental anymore. And inside, we find, when you go into this side, you're totally blown away. You come into this church and you're faced with Marc Chagall. Now, Freiburg was heavily destroyed. There was a lot of fighting, there was bombing, and it was built up. And this church, the windows were all blown out. In the late 60s, early 70s, the people of Freiburg asked Marc Chagall, the great Jewish artist, if he would be interested in doing the work for some work for him. And he undertook this work very enthusiastically, as a very spiritual man, as you know he is, as a gesture of reconciliation and peacemaking, and really a gesture that was very religious in nature. And when I came into this church, all of a sudden it's quiet and you are enveloped by these blue lights. This is the window that depicts "And God created," he called it that. The next one was the servant of God and Mary, and these are all hall windows. I can only show you details here. This was Noah, picture of Noah. He used the Old Testament figures, and David, King David. So there is a configuration of all of the emphases of the various religions, and Elijah, the prophet. And the slides can only give you an approximation of the intensity of the color, but I think you can get a pretty good feeling. Yes.
And to tell you something technical, we talk about stained glass, but most of the glass work we see is not stained glass, it's colored glass. Mm-hmm. Stained glass actually referred to painting with enamel on glass and firing it, which is what he did.
Yeah. Okay.
Those are not single pieces of glass colored by a machine.
Okay.
Those are painted on with a brush.
I want to stay in the mood for a moment. Okay.
It was pretty special.
I know.
Pretty special.
But yeah, right. Let's just look at all of the pictures. And this is the last one that's way up in the top of the ceiling. There's the Torah there. And when you come in, this is only a poor approximation. Of course, the glow on the color isn't there. But this is the interior of the church. But here's a little closer approximation of the blue in this technique
and
that
you might just
described. Yes. And I think this is perhaps an extremely a great example of spirituality in a global way, that Chagall used his art to really present a sign of peacemaking and reconciliation through his art, which, when you see it, you experience all of this. I don't think anybody can go into the church without coming away deeply moved from this. So this is what I wanted to show you.
How many windows did you do?
I didn't count them.
Lots.
So it was a church.
How many people brought some images? Do we have here?
Ruth.
Yes.
I think also.
And slides, and I guess what we can do is for the people who didn't bring slides, I guess we can come up and hold it up or pass them around our screen.
Yeah, we have a slide group.
First we have a little thing.
I was going to suggest that we see one of the pretty images while
I
play.
Yes. Oh,
but,
yes.
But I need to have the light on in order to see the music, so.
That's
Well, it may not work too well with the backlighting.
Okay. Well, that's not bad. That's bad. This was a poster which we saw advertising a children's puppet show. Tetris is a puppet show. And the title of the show was From the Cradle to the Grave, or to the Winding Sheet. And children in Mexico are introduced to death very early and in a very humorous fashion. During the El Día de los Muertos 3-day celebration, which is really All Saints and All Souls Day, children are often given little candy skulls with their names on it. They also are given candy coffins with little skeletons in it. So the Mexicans played with the idea of death, something that's very much absent from our culture. The only thing we have, of course, is Halloween for children, but it's a pale imitation of this 3-day celebration, which is massive throughout the country and which involves family celebrations.
This was in a museum. It's a clay tableau. And can you guess what it is? It's the Last Supper. I believe the individual with a dove on the head in the black is supposed to be Christ. There's a figure of a devil behind, I think, Judas, standing next to Christ. And in the background are skeletons. It's just a reminder of death. Unfortunately, this doesn't come through. But this was one of the public altars. And the painting is of Lázaro Cárdenas, one of the great presidents of Mexico, comparable to Roosevelt in this country. And so in public buildings, there will be, during this period of the Day of the Dead, honoring the public figures, will be altars filled, especially marigolds are very, very common. And here's another one to a public figure. One also sees in the streets people, families, bringing home flowers, because there are not only public altars for figures, but in nearly every home, people will have a table of remembrance or an altar honoring the dead and their family. And I think this is a wonderful tradition because people visit one another, come in, and they talk about their relatives who have died. And this is a typical altar. You see these portrait there, or picture, of I think it's a father and mother. These little paper cutouts are very much used during this holiday. It's supposed to really get the attention of the dead by these little fluttering paper pieces that are all over, actually. There are cookies here at the foot of this particular altar. There are books, perhaps the favorite books of the deceased, sometimes articles of clothing, and always candles and offerings of food, fruit, vegetables. Then we went by night to a cemetery in a very remote part of Mexico. And this was a grave, hard to see, but each grave was a mass of candles and decorated with these typical flowers, calla lilies, baby's breath, marigold, and coxcomb, usual flowers that are used. And unfortunately, you can't see this very well, but I do have a book here called The Days of the Dead. These are members of a family seated around the grave. They remained there the entire night. And the cemetery was a mass of candles and flowers and people eating, chatting. And so I just show these to you to show what one learns from other cultures. And I thought it was a wonderful testimony to ways of handling grief, not only honoring the dead, but a way of dealing with one's emotions.
Does the bullfight enter into that feeling of death or exposure to death?
Yes. Oh, yes. And the dance with death. Very much so.
We need to, not to hurry, but we need to move on so other people can do theirs too. Judy, you have?
In other words, the image of death in Mexico is a very different one from the Northern European image.
You want to turn the lights on?
Well, the thing that struck me last week was talking about how there's a point of view in you can't get away from the photographer's point of view. This particular photograph, you guys all know this one.
Yeah.
That stuck with me from college. Mm-hmm. And they had an exhibit of Dorothy Lange's work in Milwaukee, and I was able to go and see it, and I was just flipping through the book. So I
thought, well, Nikki, look what I found.
Yeah,
from my solution. But what I wanted to talk about was, quite a while ago, there was an exhibit of Avedon's photographs in the Madison Art Center. And I made a mistake of taking Katie American. There was pretty little time. And this guy takes the most incredibly impressive photos and portraits I have ever seen. And he was fascinated with cunning operators. And Nikki and I were talking about this afterwards. Nikki says this guy's an Easterner, and I'll think about this. This is an Easterner's vision of the West. Where is this guy from? Just take a stab at it. No, he's from the east. He had a picture of a physical therapist, which was near and dear to my heart, and it was the worst portrait of that woman. All you could see, she was pale, she was blonde, she had fair skin. You could see every body hair on her face. It was just awful. Now, contrast that with Imogene Cunningham, who took all of these photos in her 90s. These are all people who are 90 and older.
She was also in her 90s.
She was in her 90s at the time she took the photos. And these are, every person in this book is older than 90. Now, here's a person who isn't a Carney operator. It's kind of hard to see. The first time I saw this picture, I thought, oh, what a pretty dress. This is not a dress. This is the tattooed lady from the circus.
Oh.
These last photos in the back were taken in a nursing home. She doesn't have anything on, but her tattoo.
But the difference in the perception of the image.
And what a sensitive. Yeah. Some nuns here in the back, which I found interesting. He was kind of older. She was kind of like the nuns.
By the way, Avedon is taking photographs of older people. His father, and he does the same kind of freak show kind of thing. When you see. When Imogene Cunningham is showing a very sympathetic portrait of people who are older and vital, too.
Yeah.
And the woman who's the Carney person.
This is a picture from her today.
Yeah. What she sees out of people is vitality and life, even though they're old. And what Avedon sees is this sort of exhibitionary kind of view. And his photographs of his father look very depressing, sort of. They look diseased. It's the manner in which he does the photographing. And they look grim. They look depressing.
I just put them through here. Yeah.
She, by the way, Imogene Cunningham did beautiful photographs of her parents who both look to be very old.
This is a painting called Christine's World. It was a pastel in 1948, but it refers to the early part of World War I when women had no liberties. They were supposed to grow up and make a home. They were homemakers. And very few opportunities for them existed while they lived in tremendous resources. This is in Iowa, of course, and Christine is in the field of rich grain worth many millions of dollars. But yet she has no opportunities for education or selecting a way of work. And she must strive up that hill to be a homemaker, this picture tells me.
One correction, this is in Maine. I've been to this house.
What?
This is in Maine. This house is in Maine.
In Maine?
Maine.
The state of Maine. Oh, I see.
But he's giving that same kind of feel. Not too.
Yes.
Is there any significance for you in that she's an older lady?
She's not. She's disabled.
She is handicapped.
Yeah. When I was doing my
fieldwork in St. Paul for a sociology master's, I was putting up two pictures in my little office given to me. One, and both were by Andrew Wyeth, and both emphasized the solitariness of the human individual, just as Christina's World does. One is called Roasted Chestnuts, and maybe you've seen it. It's a teenage boy in a ragged jacket standing by a highway. The way he stands makes you know he's cold, and in front of him is a sort of an oil drum with what looks like a garbage can cover on top, but there's a fire in it. Roasted chestnuts is what he's selling. He's all alone. There's no car in sight. But I liked this, the coping. So I had this, I was putting this up on the wall. The other was called Young America, and maybe you've seen that. It's a boy on a bicycle. The raccoon tail is flying from the back fender of the bicycle. You don't see his face, but he's all alone, and the horizon, as in Christina's World, stretches out where the... I was nailing this on the wall when the janitor came in, an American Indian. He said, oh, you're getting settled. You're putting up your pictures. I said, yes. He said, up on fourth floor in this building, there's a picture you ought to see. It's a woman in a field. She's kind of crawling uphill. Isn't that marvelous that you recognize the style? And the
I was looking at photographs. We talked a lot about how much the maker, the photograph, puts into them, and therefore the uniqueness to the situation or the author, the creator, or the individuality. But something that something that happened recently to me made me think also of the timelessness of certain kinds of photographs because of their topics, where the topic becomes more than what the person's putting into it. The thing that happened was I was taking care of a friend's house, and he had up a picture of himself when he was about six. He had just made his first communion, and anyone in the audience who's ever been to a first communion of a Roman Catholic family knows that they always take a picture of the children in whatever...